Chris Evans with a Storage Impact podcast. I'm here with Martin, and it's been a while, Martin.
It has indeed. Well, what's happened since we've last spoken? We've had a heat wave. We've had biblical flood like yesterday, according to you.
Oh, crikey, yeah. I was in London yesterday for the cricket, and it was unbelievable.
What, the cricket or the rain?
Well, the cricket mostly didn't happen. The ladies' match happened. It was very good. But, yeah, the men's didn't. It got completely washed out. Although it's quite funny, some guy decided it would be really fun to run up and run onto the covers and just do a body slide across the whole covers.
Yeah.
The second time he did it, the crowd all got all revved up and were, you know, going, whoa, as he did it. Yeah. And then he came off and ran into the crowd and had to run off as the stewards chased him into the crowd to try and get hold of him. But it was fun.
Did the crowd try and get in the way of the stewards to make sure he got away?
There was nobody at that lower level by that stage. Okay. Everybody was hiding because of the rain, lightning probably. So he just dived down into one of the stairs to the lower level and tried to clear off. But it was fun to watch.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So, yeah, lots happened, I think, in terms of non-work stuff. But we haven't been here for a while. Mainly a bit of a summer break, you know. I think it's been nice to have a bit of a break.
Refocus,
get back in again.
Yeah, I think so. I think we've always had a summer break. Be interested to see whether we have a bit more of a break. So what's happened in the world of storage while we've been away?
Well, not a lot really, you know. I was going to talk to you about this before we dive into our topic of the day. And I was wondering whether we've seen a bit of a slowdown in the market with release of new products, new features. Because obviously, first of all, vendors are moving towards the idea of as a service. So HPE, Dell, Pure, everybody. A sort of NetApp, all trying to do as a service, so that they're not going to be talking about machines and nuts and bolts and stuff. It's all going to be feature. And I just wonder whether partly there's been a bit of a slowdown in that evolution of stuff because of COVID.
Maybe. Or is storage just done? Should we just give up, Chris?
Well, that's a very good question. Should we just give up? I have a feeling that we might choose to what's the best way to describe this? What does Madonna always do? Reinvent herself. Maybe we'll reinvent ourselves and become a bit more broader in what we talk about. But at the essence, I'm sure we'll still consider doing storage because there is still stuff there, perhaps not at the same rate that we've seen it before.
Well, I think today's topic is, although it's storage, it sort of hints at the direction which we might take. We're going to talk about AWS, aren't we? And some of our new cloud offerings.
Absolutely. So, the title for this podcast, AWS gets a SAN upgrade. That might be a bit of a joke, really, because clearly they're not running any sort of SAN behind the scenes in the traditional way for an enterprise. But they are at least running some degree of, let's call it, scalable storage, which has to be addressed somehow. So, yeah, we're going to talk about that today.
Are you sure they're not running a SAN? They're very secretive at times about what they actually are running. So you never know. We could have a load of Brocade switches out there. Probably Muckdata. They've probably got a load on eBay.
Yeah, well, you know, you could still build it, couldn't you? Yeah, it'd be interesting. Yeah. Actually, funny enough, you should say that, what is it they're running? Because as part of the research, you know, the masses of research that we do for every podcast, I did do a search to see if I could find out exactly what they were running and how they were running it. But there's very little out there. There's very little information at all to give you a clue as to what the technology is behind the scenes.
So either Google and AWS are very, very secretive to a sense about their special source. They'll tell you about everybody else's special source and they'll leak like a sieve about who their customers are, but actually trying to find out what they do is the long-running question. We're not talking about, this is the opposite end of the scale. Glacier, what Glacier is, depending who you talk to, if it's tape, it isn't tape. I can exclusively reveal it's punch cards and elves.
Excellent, and probably fiber channel over token ring for the SAN side of things.
It could well be.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start by at least having an idea of what EBS, the Elastic Block Store, really is, because that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about EBS, the block store that's connected to EC2. So what is EBS? I did a bit of research. It was really first offered around 2008, which was there was a sort of standard EBS block storage solution, which, believe it or not, was 100 IOPS, 100 IOPS per volume.
Is that a disk spindle?
It must have been. It must have been in 2008. I couldn't have seen how it could have been anything else. IO1, which is, you know, Amazon use all these acronyms, don't they? Like numbers and letters to describe different services. So IO1 was the first provisioned IOPS service introduced in 2012, which was 4 years after EC2 had actually come out. And at that point, IO1 offered 1,000 IOPS. So that was a big increase, tenfold at that point. But even then, and this is quite an important point to go through, that you'll, I think, come back time and time again, performance was aligned with capacity. So if you wanted a greater number of IOPS, you had to add more capacity. So you were sort of tied to, if you really needed the IOPS, either merging or raiding volumes together at the application layer, or you had to just buy a bigger volume than you needed, which seems a bit silly, really.
Yeah, it feels like scaling with spindles. They're doing something like wide striping or something like that. It doesn't feel like flash at the moment.
Yeah, so I think obviously that increase was because they had a very specific IO density, and IO density comes back time and time again when you look at the service. So then we, over time, we saw incremental improvements, and I pulled out a little screenshot which actually shows a table of this. So and to be fair, the IO density has increased significantly over the years. So August 2012 was 1,000. So by August 2014, it was up to, well, it depends on the size of the volume, but let's say March 2015, it was at 20,000. November 2018, it was 64,000. So bit by bit, they have increased this depending on the block size. I think there was in 2014, there were some numbers that were a bit higher, but that was based on the, I think, the different block sizes. So there has been an increase in the IO density significantly until last year. And then we had something called IO2. And IO2 sort of sets a slightly different benchmark. And the difference between IO1 and IO2 is actually not what you think. It's not all performance. It's actually not performance at all. In reality, it's about going from 3 nines to 5 nines in terms of availability. So enterprise-like. And a few performance increases, but generally, IO2 standard isn't that much faster or that much different to IO1, because I think IO1 had seen all of the SSD improvements in it come along as they, bit by bit, they improved the performance and the IO density.
Yeah, at some point, I'd like to circle back, probably not on this podcast, about availability. It's a really interesting topic to talk about when we talk about clouds. I mean, this concept of 3 nines, Chris, we've been around for long enough in the enterprise. If we've started designing systems which are 3 nines, we would have been unemployed.
Absolutely. And it's really funny to see that 5 nines has come along, and it makes you wonder whether there has been a bit of a not backlash, but certainly a sort of a awakening or a realization that a lot of enterprises probably aren't really converting their applications into being cloud native as such. They're not building resiliency at the application layer to cope with the fact that the cloud could be semi-resilient. And in fact, they're just asking for higher availability for individual VMs or instances.
Makes sense.
Mm. So when did we see, this month we saw IO2 Block Express, as it's now called, come out. Now this did give us a significant increase in performance and a reduction in latency. So now what we see is sub-millisecond latency being quoted, whereas with the previous environments it wasn't. We saw an increase in the maximum capacity of volumes to 64 terabytes, and the maximum IOPS to 256,000, and a throughput per volume of 4,000 megabytes per second, 4 gig a second, which, pretty good numbers, you know, that's pretty good. Nothing wrong with that, they're reasonable. But it's taken, 12 years to get to this point?
Yeah, and I think if we're looking at very high performance, low latency storage, are Amazon really going to track what's going on around in the high performance storage devices at the moment? It seems like a big lag.
Mm. So I suppose you look at it and think, well, okay, latency, and you look at the use cases that they talked about. A lot of the use cases are, you know, being able to run traditional databases, I guess SAP, Oracle, you know, all that sort of thing. Well, latency would have been super critical. So again, it makes me wonder whether there was some real kickback on the latency thing that said, you just simply can't increase the IOPS and throughput to get the performance you need for certain databases. And every time I've looked at any Amazon performance numbers, it's always about IOPS and throughput. It's never about latency.
Yeah, latency is difficult. And depending how they design their data centers, latency could be more complex for them. It could be a lot more variable. Certainly when we start getting to the very high speed, the very low latency things where distance does matter. If they've got very large data centers, they might find they've got some kind, and they're not guaranteeing where things are. They've got some flutters and some jitter in their latency. And we do know that can kill some applications.
I suppose a lot of this probably comes down to the fact that they don't want to actually build SANs. They don't want to build the traditional enterprise-style infrastructure because the impact of trying to build centralized storage, scale-out servers means you could introduce a lot of overhead in terms of moving workloads around. It might actually be very difficult to provision things in a dynamic way. Certainly wouldn't have been that easy in 2008, for example, to use any sort of API or automation with centralized storage. And obviously just the cost, you know, the cost of using enterprise storage, traditional enterprise storage from vendors wouldn't have scaled. So obviously they've had to come up with something different. And maybe that's the reason why it's become a challenge for them, because they built their own scale-out solution that has to cope with the network and everything else around it.
Yeah, they do. Network, the storage, everything around it. And I think you may well be right. This could be a real impact of the enterprise. The enterprise who isn't willing to rewrite their applications in such a way which changes failure domains, what they expect from latency, more tolerant of Netflix's Chaos Monkey. If we have people who are just moving virtual machines as EC2s into EC2s, we're going to expect something. So Amazon may not want to create a SAN, but they're having to create all the capabilities of the SAN.
Yeah. And I don't think that's an unreasonable surprise to us that enterprises haven't looked at it and thought, yeah, great, let's move to the cloud. Or at the same time, let's completely rewrite our applications. Because at the end of the day, the migration to cloud isn't going to be just purely because you really feel like rewriting your application to use that technology. You're potentially going to move and think, okay, I want to not run data centers. I want to have an OPEX model. And there's lots of other reasons why you might make that move other than rewriting the code. So yes, you could go to Amazon and various other providers and use VMware in that scenario, but there are restrictions around that. Yeah. There's extra licensing costs. But there may be applications you just think, do you know what, I'm not rewriting that because it's not worth the effort, but I really don't want to run it on-prem, but I need a certain degree of availability, so I'd like to just run it as a cloud instance and just call it quits.
Yeah, I think there's lots of reasons why they'd needed to do this. They may find that they've made development and developers' lives very easy. But it's very difficult once you develop to produce a piece of code which doesn't perform properly or doesn't perform what you expect. And if people are saying, you know what, we can take this code which has been developed and we can move it back on premises and we know we're going to get it to run faster.
Oh, now there's an interesting thought. Yeah, we haven't discussed that yet. We should come back to that, because that's an interesting point. You know, you develop something in the cloud and then think, actually, I'm going to run this locally because I've looked at the cost, it's more practical, or it just might well run that much better when it's running on-prem. So touching on why the storage performance increase was needed from a technical perspective, because we just touched there very much on the sort of business angle, I think one thing that's incredibly obvious when you go back and look at some of the older blogs and some of the old discussions is how much EC2 has evolved in the last 15 years, well, since 2008 or whatever, whenever it was first introduced. I can't remember the exact date for EC2. And you look at things that talk about the 1 gig network and they talk about certain processor types and the size of memory. And you look at what we've got now and you look at the increase in performance that came from things like the introduction of the Nitro chips and various other things. It's light years in terms of difference, the EC2 infrastructure and what you can do with it.
EC2 developments have really tracked what's going on in the data center. I think that's fair enough to say, certainly if we stop that. But I think our feeling is storage hasn't tracked as much. Network probably falls somewhere between the two of them. And I actually think one of the problems is actually where Amazon have come from storage, where they've come about it. S3 was their thing. Yeah. I think they never really thought that anybody would need anything more than a small amount of compute storage. Where EBS has grown might well have been a surprise, and that isn't a planned growth at all. It showed that they didn't quite understand what they were getting into. So they've required this block storage, which they can write, layer POSIX file system on the top, to support the workloads which people want to run. Lots of people don't want to rewrite their applications to talk to an S3 object.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you look at EC2, you look at possibly true of Azure. I'm not sure it's true of GCP because they're slightly later. But you look at, say, OpenShift, you look at the way that Docker came along and then the way that Kubernetes started. All of these platforms made an assumption that storage would be ephemeral, that it wouldn't have to be persistent. And then bit by bit, they've adopted persistent storage. Now, the question is, Was that because they didn't think that's the way that storage was going to go, that they could just get away with ephemeral storage and application level recovery? Or was that because they didn't understand storage and they started with something simple and have had to increase the quality of that over time?
I don't think they've ever really understood storage as an integral part of your compute tier beyond something your operating system and maybe your application binaries live on. I think at times that is obvious, certainly in Google and Amazon. Microsoft must have understood. They've been doing this for such a long time.
You would have hoped so. But, you know, to me, that's a question that I'm not really sure I understand the answer to, as to why you would build an infrastructure that didn't do that, unless you were trying to create something totally new and radical and different and saying, hey, we're not going to do it the same way. You could sort of understand that, but actually in reality, that's not the way the market has evolved. And maybe that shows a bit of a naivety around the way that enterprises would go and the fact that they thought that enterprises would adopt what they were creating, when in actual fact, the enterprise wants what it's had for the last 50, 60 years in terms of IT,
yeah,
which is, you know, persistent storage and compute and networking. It's not rocket science. I'll tell you what's really interesting coming out of this, which I'm not really sure that I know the answer to, but I think it's really interesting to see the adoption of Nitro as a technology to help in this market. So we saw the acquisition of E8,
yep,
which I looked up, 31st of July, 2019. And that acquisition, the next day, their website was dead. They were gone. Everything was, you know, wiped off. And I'm not really sure whether they were acquired for the technology or whether they were acquired for the people, because I'm not sure how much of that technology has gone into Blockstore, if at all, or whether they had ideas that they thought they could incorporate, or whether they were already working on something and said, we just need people to understand this better. But it does seem to me that the Nitro usage and the acquisition of E8 were two quite big drivers in making sure that IO2 and IO2 Block Express were actually working.
I haven't thought about that, but yeah, I think you're right. And it'd be interesting to do these roadmaps based on acquisitions at times, work out what they bought, what the missing piece was. Obviously, I think it was a missing piece, and it may be they were having lots of customers who were asking for this, and they realised that to develop it themselves was going to be years, 2, 3, 4 years. Yep. But and they had to do something, otherwise adoption of their cloud services was going to slow. Which we've already started to see anyway in some places. So
yeah,
they didn't really need any other forces pushing back against the adoption.
And it was a good acquisition because at the end of the day, the model fits really well. So obviously it's been a while since we talked to EIP, and we couldn't talk to them any longer because they no longer exist. But when we did talk to them, and we have got a podcast we did quite a long time ago, which I will share the link to, their technology was effectively a centralized storage shelf with clients that talk to the storage over NVMe over fabrics. So you can imagine that in Amazon's world, they could have decided just to put shelves in or servers with large amounts of physical storage. And then that became shared out between other clusters. And something like that must have gone into the on-premises side of things, just, you know, to make that work. They must have got some version of that technology in on-prem, because they obviously, when they ship you, what's the platform?
Outposts,
yeah. When they ship you that, there's a certain degree of local storage included in that. So they yeah. must have a distributed model in that. So and it's not dedicated storage. It's not like a storage, like a SAN or anything, but obviously it's there. So clearly that was a missing piece, which they made work, and there we are. So we know that they obviously have needed to increase performance, speeds, reduce latency, all the rest of it. There's the lift and shift thing we talked about already. Now, I think the interesting thing is that they have made incremental changes. You know, that has definitely been there. It's not the big bang thing. But we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I think, or at least on the last podcast, where we were talking about how somebody, a company or an organization of the size and scale of Amazon, could actually go about refreshing their technology and how hard it would be. So it's not really a surprise that storage is not refreshed every 6 months with new features, because it's hard.
It is hard. It's doing that at scale. Certainly anything which has dramatic performance increases is going to be hard, because you think about it. And even we're now talking about mass global rollouts. You don't want to upset too many of your customers. You don't want to say, well, actually, we're only going to run it in Northwest One, or what regions do you target? Obviously, you but you've got to get it out there eventually. You can't just roll it out to North America. You've got to roll it out into Europe. You've got to roll it into APAC. We're talking about thousands upon thousands upon thousands of servers.
Yeah.
Probably many more disks.
Yeah. So here's a thought. When they went from IO1 to IO2, other than availability, there wasn't much in terms of improvement in performance and throughput. So how long have people been running on IO2 without realizing they've been running on IO2? Has IO2 been rolled out for the last 2 years, 3 years, and it's been in use in the background, but they've been calling it IO1, whilst they've been absolutely certain that the technology is resilient and works? And then when they were 100% sure, then they could come in and say, okay, and now we can offer the other features of IO2. We just didn't tell you you were already running on that. Because it's cloud. Nobody has to know what you're running in the background.
This is a really interesting subject, and you could start thinking about this. How do you know what piece of kit you're really running on? You have no idea. So you could find yourself running on the very latest generation. Do Amazon artificially throttle at this point? Do they just improve their VM density? What do they do? Or do you suddenly discover that you've got a bunch of VMs, which all EC2 instances are now running faster?
Yeah.
Is there mileage in somebody starting to randomly spin up VMs? And actually, this is something which I know which has been done in the past. People were, and I think Netflix, or certainly a company of that scale at one point, were spinning up thousands of VMs and triaging out the slow ones.
Yeah.
Now,
for that exact reason, yeah.
Do you triage out, or do you look for the fast ones and try and work out what's going on? Do you start to see that you've got different performance characteristics?
There's multiple answers and there's multiple angles to that question. So first of all, I can see why if they are doing it, I can see why they do it. Time to roll out some technology, it takes a long, long time. So you might decide, we'll roll out the actual protocol, the infrastructure, the actual architecture of the storage, even if we haven't kitted it out with the fastest, biggest devices at that point. So we need to be able to just have the connectivity, for example. We need to roll out the protocol change. We need to do all the things that gets people hooked into Nitro so that the actual, you know, infrastructure is working on it, even if we haven't decided to upgrade the servers that store the storage and we haven't done that piece yet. And then you slowly start to move people across and you're confident, and then you start saying, well, actually, we've got a couple of racks here of that technology. We'll start just pulling out the drives and putting in the new ones, or we turn those servers off, or the racks of servers off, and we turn on the new ones. And lo and behold, you're on the new technology. Should you care and should you want to triage that about, you know, in terms of performance? It sort of makes sense to think that you should do if you're really using that many virtual machines, but then shouldn't you be expecting a very consistent performance? So does IO2, for instance, introduce a more consistent profile? And is that part of the upgrade as well as everything else? Those sort of questions I think would be really interesting to understand.
Yeah, I think across the piece. Difference in performance in different regions would be really interesting to understand. But obviously, I know some work people have done and try to work out how close their workloads run from a rack point of view. Are they running the same rack? Are they running in different bits? I mean, there's always questions. But imagine a DR scenario or an active-active scenario where you're running multi-region and one region runs faster. Or if you're in a DR and you fail over to a region, you suddenly find it's running 10% slower. Now, is that because you're in a DR state, or is it because what you're running on is different? How do Amazon guarantee a certain degree of performance? And this is where it gets awkward, actually. And I've talked about this before, because if you get more than what you pay for, just so you're running in a region, it's running a lot faster. That's great. Then you have to fail to a different server or a different region, and it runs slower. Amazon may have a problem because you've got an unhappy customer.
Yeah.
Because they're like, hang on, this is running a lot slow. What's going on? And I was like, well, you're getting what you paid for. But it was running faster over there. No, but you're getting what you paid for. It's understanding that consistency of model.
It's a tricky question. So, you know, going back to our enterprise days, I really didn't like the fact that in some of the technology I put in, you would deploy a new array. And the first time that array went in, first few customers who were on it would see super fast performance. But the customers that came along at the end would see not so good performance. Now, theoretically, those customers might not have been that bothered because they're the ones that come on at the end, and what they experience is what they've not seen before, so that doesn't matter. But the people who were first on that system, say 12 months ago, might start saying, well, hold on, this seems to have slowed down somewhat.
Yeah.
And without quality of service at that level, and quality of service only ever seems to target IOPS and bandwidth, which is what Amazon already do. There's no latency control in there by anybody around QoS. QoS is still ignored for latency. So if you're latency sensitive, then you have a big problem.
Yeah.
I actually did a bit of work with a certain large building society in the UK where they merged two three-letter acronym vendors' technology together, our favourite vendor, and they didn't sort of explain to the customer that both arrays had different I/O profiles. So one array was faster than the other in terms of the older technology. They got merged onto a brand new array, which is much bigger. But of course, as that merger happened, some applications went faster. Some applications went slower. So some customers, internal customers, were happy, and some internal customers were not very happy at all. But there was no way to manage that. It just, it's one of those things, just the way it works, unless you start going mad and putting in all sorts of complex tiering. So it does matter that the technology is consistent wherever you go. And that's not really what a lot of cloud providers offer, I don't think.
I've never heard it properly explored in the technical press. The difference and things, and it's quads, right? Quads seems to be always a bit, Chris, about a minimum level of performance.
Yes,
you may actually want a maximum level of performance.
I think you should. I absolutely think you should. You know, if I look at latency, I would say I might want to not give you anything better than a millisecond, even if I can deliver it faster than that, because you haven't paid for it. You know, not only that, but it's not a case of you haven't paid for it. It's a case of I may need to offer that latency in 6 months' time on that same infrastructure to somebody else. I need to make to balance that out in the future. So I can't afford to be able to necessarily give it to you straight off without any controls.
Yeah, and it might not be doing you any favors anyway, because it might just be hiding you a load of problems you don't know about.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so where have we got to? We're just talking generally about some of the challenges here. I've got a great one, and I think it's really interesting. And that's when we look at the way that this is headed. So let's assume that new technology came in to deliver IO2 and the new features. And we know that within that mix, there's Nitro. We've already started to see some vendors like Nebulon and Fungible build in their own smart NICs and their own technology that is of an equivalent style to the way that Nitro is working. Not entirely. There are other bits of Nitro that are not there. But does that use of Nitro in AWS imply that that might be the way we head in the enterprise, to not have big honking centralized SANs anymore?
I thought we were heading that way anyway for compute storage.
Yeah.
I make a big difference between compute storage and persistence data stores.
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm sure Mr. Ferrero listens to us, but I'm not convinced he does. I actually tend to agree with him when he says SANs must die. And actually, I think that's probably true for most use cases.
Yeah, I see that's the argument for that, yeah.
But distributing your storage in a particular way doesn't, also not convinced. So yeah, do I think Fungible and Nebulon are going to change the way we do data centers? I think they will. I think we'll change it for the big data centers. I can't see why you'd want to run a small data center these days anyway. I mean, I think if you're really thinking, I can't imagine very many people are building a greenfield SAN.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to do anymore.
I hope you're not. I hope people on this and aren't doing it. I'm really sorry, Brocade, or Broadcom as you are now, I think. Isn't it Broadcom?
Can't remember.
I can't remember who's called.
I have so little to do with it anymore that I forget, to be honest, sometimes.
Yeah. Don't build new SANs. There are probably better ways of doing it. So I think Nebulon Fungible, I think they've looked at, to some extent, what Amazon have been doing with Nitro, I think, but maybe there's some parallel development. It was the right time for it. But search from a storage point of view, we could go down the same way. And then what impact does that have?
Yeah, I think I can see an angle for still having centralized storage. I can see a lot of benefit from still having something that centralizes your resources, or at least makes it easier from a management perspective. You know, the whole point of why we went down the route of the SAN in the first place, or at least one angle of it, was to centralize resources from a cost perspective, but also from a maintenance perspective, not to have to go around managing individual servers and their failure domains and be able to have that centralized. Yes, there is other benefits, and it, obviously, you know, we could spend a week talking about why we got to where we got to, But I don't think we want to go back to the situation where every server has storage in it and we now have to track what's in where and manually be going in and out of stuff. So I think we can still centralize the physical aspects of the storage. So for instance, we could do racks of JBODs that just don't have any sort of real intelligence. But then we then map those out with NVMe over Fabric so that we provide access, which is exactly what E8 did, which is what VAST are doing, which is what other vendors have tried to do as well. And in that respect, you centralize physically, but you don't try and go mad with lots of complex technology and features and functionality that you just probably don't need anymore.
We call it an SAN, a stupid storage area network.
Yeah, or a simple SAN.
Yeah, simple SAN. There you are. Yeah. That's what we want, the simple SAN.
Yeah. And so I can see that working, and I think that makes a lot of sense, because if all you're using it for is compute and you're going to have some other place to keep the data afterwards, or if you're just running database instances where, you know, the probably the most complex feature you need is snapshots, if that, then what's the big deal? I mean, at the end of the day, nobody uses synchronous replication in the cloud. And I think your view, you've said many times, you think synchronous replication doesn't really have a future anyway.
I don't think it does. Speed of light's not going to change.
Well, not in our universe.
Always problematic with synchronous storage.
Yeah,
and actually it has no place in cloud. I suppose you could do it between availability zones, AZs, within a data center if it's small enough. But obviously, when you get into true multi-region, well, you're not going to Amazon, Google, Azure, don't you know, build their data centers close enough for it to make any sense at all.
No, and that's the difference between what we generally see as the EU model or the European model and the American model. They typically wouldn't do synchronous. They just do async over distance, whereas we would do a bit more sync because we've got closely located data centers. But that's not the model they apply. But that's fair enough. That makes sense. So we've looked across quite a number of different features, Martin, lots of different things. I'd like to talk a little bit about a number of implications that come from what we've learned and what we've just discussed. And the first one is, what comes after EC2? What do we do next?
Do you mean what comes after EC2 or what comes after EBS?
Well, a combination of both, really. So we already know that containerization is coming along and there are persistent features built in there. But the question is, for that and for typical EC2, do we end up needing some sort of different storage approach for all of these technologies going forward?
Well, at the moment, it's not available for these different technologies. And I think that's the interesting thing. So I'm thinking, okay, so where does IO2 and IO2 Express fit into the world of serverless, these higher level functions? Well, actually, you may still want very high performance storage.
Yeah.
You may want your database as a service running at a very high performance level. You might want your serverless running at very high, or dealing with data at a very high performance level. I know it's an assumption mostly with serverless, you will deal with it. You will deal with S3 volumes. Maybe we'll see S3 Express. There seems to be a whole load of areas which aren't looked at the moment.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting angle first of all, we should point out that, and this is quite relevant to another point in a moment, EBS is internally proprietary to Amazon in the sense that you connect an EBS volume to an EC2 instance and nothing else. Whereas the other technologies that you just described, I think, like S3, are more open for the wider world. But the question is, would it be more practical to offer internally connected, where Amazon can control the network and everything else, high performance S3, even higher performance EFS than they have today, and high performance block? And almost, do we need to standardize on that so you can just pick what you want as a protocol or even a connectivity and just say, I just want that device and I want to see it this way.
I will go back to your thing about EBS, because there is an open EBS project which really hasn't got very much traction. I think there's some good reasons for it, because it doesn't really do anything particularly useful. EBS you can fake, because it's just a block storage device. Whereas reason S3, and S3 isn't a standard either. Let's admit, Amazon had to control it, but lots of people have just implemented their own version. It's not standard. Amazon could do whatever they liked with it if they wanted. They could really mess with people. I don't think they're going to. I think that would be a really bad move for them.
Yeah. But I suppose it is a question we've talked about before, and that is, do we need to do something new on protocols? Do we need to do something different? Have we got to a point where actually we need, you know, like we talked about NVMe over Fabrics and the fact that you can do key value store coming up, do we need to sort of get past this physical protocol aspect and try and look at it more from a storage and logical process aspect. And maybe somebody could be super creative and come up with something, and that might be, you know, a real leap in the storage world.
Well, I hope so, because otherwise it's going to be a very boring 10 years or so, Chris, as we head towards retirement.
Yes, we talk about the same things over and over again. Yeah, we certainly can't do that. Definitely not. Okay. All right. I'm going to wrap up with one comment then. And I think this one came out as I was doing the research, and I think this is quite relevant. And that's, we've only had, you know, 10, 15 years of public cloud in general. And that seems quite a long time, but for some customers it probably isn't. They might only have been involved for a few years, and you know, at some point you have to do a refresh. Now, refresh might typically be refreshing the application, and at the time you do the refresh, then you move the application off and you build a new server, and then and on you go. That might have been the way it was done in the enterprise. But I wonder, because cloud is obviously clearly not static and there's a constant refresh, I wonder how many people have actually looked at it and said, I need to refresh my virtual instances. I need to refresh the storage it's sitting on. I need to move on my applications on a fairly frequent basis. And I don't really think I know the answer to that.
I don't think very many people are looking at it from that point of view. I think refresh cycles, I think what you've seen is a disconnection, hopefully, between hardware and application operating system and infrastructure software refresh cycles. If you're running in cloud, why would you worry? Obviously, the cloud tools themselves need to make it very easy for somebody if they want to change the instance type. So a refresh is just, I click a button and it reboots itself and it comes back as a new instance type. Obviously, that's very storage focused as well, because actually all you're doing is you're bringing up a piece of hardware and it's got the same external volumes. You've always been able to do a refresh like that with some complications, some limitations, but I think sometimes people get very excited about it. Certainly, but if you had boot from SAN, you could do that.
Yes, you could. Absolutely. No problem.
So then what does a refresh mean? Now, when you've got EBS, refreshing EBS, so you decide, I've now refreshed my instance type. It's now running faster. I now need to, turn up the dial on my storage, basically. I need to refresh that. How easy is that? And I want to do this in as non-disruptive way. I almost want it exactly the same as I can with an instance. Basically, I just want to bounce and it's there and it's on the latest. That's more difficult to do. So what tools are we going to see to allow people to say, move that EBS volume to that EBS volume. I don't want it to impact. And then when you finished it, just boot it.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether that's really that flexible at this point. So for example, the IO2 Block Express devices are only available on certain R5 instances, which obviously are a specific generation, but you get that automatically even if you didn't ask for it. So clearly there's a block of technology being rolled out each time, and every time that technology is rolled out, it's got certain storage and compute and potentially networking involved in it. So these things aren't separate like they may have been in an enterprise, where a storage array went in and it connected to 15 different flavors of OS and server and type and size and model. There still seems to be quite a close coupling between the two. So as long as you could refresh both at the same time, then yeah, great. That's probably not a problem. But then that gets back to that discussion of, if you do that and you suddenly see your application running faster or running differently, does that cause you a headache, or is it just, yeah, great, I've got some improvement? You know, do you really want it to work like that?
There are problems when applications do run faster. All kinds of things, all kind of timing issues throw up.
Yeah.
I'm sure Amazon don't necessarily believe that, or maybe not necessarily, weren't expecting people to run applications of that type in their cloud. I think there's been a lot of assumptions, or a lot of, when this came along, I think it was a lot of thinking that people were going to refactor a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Reality is, people don't refactor very much.
No, I'd agree. It's hard
work. It's hard work. And that's where I think some of this could come up. Not necessarily unstuck, but you're not going to get the full value out of cloud.
Yeah. And I think on that point, I can wrap up by saying, at the end of the day, cloud is just still somebody else's computer.
Well done. You got it in.
Because it is, isn't it? Let's face it. All the things we've just talked about, at all of the stuff, even now, even the way that cloud works, you still get that feeling that it's just somebody else's computer sitting behind it. You don't necessarily, we're not, we still haven't got to an abstraction where it doesn't count anymore. It doesn't, you don't care.
You know, I know some Amazon employees listen to this. I would love them, but they won't. But to come on and talk to us and explain how we're planning, how we're thinking of dealing with some of this. They're still relatively young in the world of IT as a company, but they must have gone through at least one or two refresh cycles. How do you deal with this? And how do we deal with this? Both Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, and IBM, how do you do this at unimagined scale?
That is probably the most interesting thing. You know, the wealth of experience about how to deal with stuff at scale is unparalleled, I think, for the cloud providers compared to other people. There are probably very few organizations that are that global, that have that level of need to think about scale. I mean, you could probably think of things like airlines maybe, or telecoms providers or whatever, who are truly global, but there aren't many organizations that have to deal with something as complex as that. Maybe that's a discussion for another time if we get somebody to talk to us.
Oh, yeah. Anybody from Hyperscaler or anybody who's got real experience with this, that would be a really interesting thing to talk about.
Absolutely. But for now, Martin, great conversation, as always. Yeah. Thank you very much. And I'm glad we're back in the saddle about recording again, and look forward to catching up next time.
Cool.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.